Hello, this is Peter Hill Explains, in which I discuss things scientific and basically develop tutorial techniques in terms of podcasts. I'm doing the 2016 final year physics exam, school exam, in the area of quantum quarks, question 34 from, as I said before, 2016. And I'm just souping up when to, you know, specialising when to actually give a lecture, read the question, do some formula, actually answer the question, get it all together. So what I've decided to do is that I'll read the question first. So this question is so long that I've broken up into three podcasts and three little groups. The first group of two questions is typically a calculation. The next group is a bit more of a description. The last one's usually a evaluation where you've actually got to actually go through and do a little bit of English. Now, we're in the middle section, and I'm going to read the middle section's questions C and D. Describe how contributions to the atomic theory made by Pauli and Heisenberg changed Bohr's model of the atom. And D, explain how the evidence from experiments involving particle accelerators and detectors has provided support for the standard model of matter. So for this, there's no equation, so I'm just going to give the general tutorial and then actually skip the equations and get back into the actual stuff. Now, I should warn that these tutorials are basically rehab tutorials for me, in which I just data dump information that's in my head, and then when I say, oh, I'm a bit slow on that one, I'll go back and actually look it up and actually think about it. Okay, so the things happened really, really quickly. So around 1911, Rutherford fired helium nuclei into a gold foil and saw that most went straight through it and a few collided off a very solid object. And that very solid object, by statistics, had to be very small, 1/1,000,000th the volume of the entire atom. So it was extremely, extremely small. That's 1,000,000,000,000,000th of the atom. Had a very small, small volume of the nucleus. That meant the seeming idea is that the rest was empty space, and a combination with the Drude model and the discovery that a electron is 1,820th or 23, I just have to go back and check the mass of an atom, led Bohr to come up with the idea that the electron was really small. And another similar analogy is the Earth is very small compared to the Sun. Again, that's, we now know differently in the starting of the 1926, we definitely, with Schrodinger's wave equation, we definitely moved the other way. So let's look at Bohr's theory, planetary theory of the atom, and he had a series of three things. I'm just data dumping off the top of my head. He said that electrons were in stable orbits, circular orbits, rotating, accelerating charges, but they violated the law of physics. They had a special out because if an electron's travelling in a circle, it will radiate energy, i.e. that's what an antenna is. So an antenna is a one-dimensional circle up and down. Two is that basically it's like a super antenna rotating an electron in a field like that. He says, oh, that's not off. He said that they're in stable orbits, and when they transition between the stable orbits, they absorb and emit light. And the third thing was to do with the angular momentum, giving putting a thing about the angular momentum h of h bar transition. This is probably relevant of a photon. So h bar gave you the actual orbital positions, which correspond to the Rydberg equation, which was sitting out there for the taking for the person who had actually come up with it. Now Heisenberg and Pauli were both Austrian physicist, and Heisenberg's, I suppose, the one that comes a bit before. He developed the matrix form of describing particles. He began to work on the quantum aspect of it too, and so he had the matrix theory of quantum mechanics, which is basically what we have today, the matrix theory. That's the Brown and Ketz and all the quantum mechanical theories, the symbols, the wave functions go into a matrix to get in all your different values. And so he had the matrix theory, and sort of interesting chap, just aside, he basically had, when he went to Britain, he had a wife and a living lover. So he sort of extended uncertainty into his own life and lived quite well on that. I think drifted off and looked at colours and other things like that. Heisenberg, there's, I think he's got a few famous books up there. But he also came up with the uncertainty principle to do with different vectors. Now, that was seized on by people who seized on this with the Copenhagen school and came up with a Born approximation of wave functions, which were later discovered to say that a wave function is the probability of finding an electron within this region of space. So this is basically a fairly discredited theory, but it's sort of the main theory that people believe on in at school. And they have this, that if you can imagine you have a sock in your house, in your quantum mechanical house, the sock will be in front of you, but then it will disappear and reappear at another position. Just disappear from the universe and reappear. It actually doesn't physically move due to any sort of physics or equations that we understand. It's just so small, and it's philosophically a sock which moves across. So that's the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So that's the Born probability field equation in the Copenhagen school, sort of a fairly discredited thing. So the sock is basically a quantum, a classical version of the electron. That's the idea, because it's light, it's very small, whereas as you down Schrodinger, something which is very light is very large. Sorry for telling you all this. So Heisenberg said the expectation value or the uncertainty, he said precision, the imprecision idea, we call it uncertainty. That is, if you multiply the precision that you can know, momentum times the precision of position, if you multiply those two together, you get a constant. So so there's a certain amount of uncertainty. So as you understand position, you don't understand momentum, and there's various mad theories. And of course, the interesting is you go off to people who've come up with these theories, and you say, "Oh, look, would you like to read this paper? Would you like to do that? Would you like to hear that such and such a proof that you've quoted has been disproved in 1935 or something like that?" They smile and just think you're an idiot. But I'm a quantum physicist, and I went off and did supercomputer calculations and discovered new molecules. But I don't think they did that. But they've got infinite self-face. So that's Heisenberg. So Heisenberg, but the people sort of, I don't know, changed the model with Heisenberg. It's sort of all a very low-key sort of thing. Pauli had different particles, and he basically said, before he actually discovered fermion and spin, he eventually proposed spin. I think Dirac came up with a more definitive idea of spin, and then we got the symmetries to break through to understand it. And this is all looking at their relativistic quantum equation brought out what's spin is. And it's actually, I suppose, interesting like that. So Wolfgang Pauli was a Austrian super physicist born in 1900. So him coming up with ideas in 1922 is when he's 22 years old, and he was the grandson of Ernst Mach. So Mach, for me, is the super villain of this is Mach as the Mach number. I think it is the same Mach. I have to think about it. So if it is the same Mach, which is that Austrian physicist who terrorised Boltzmann and led Boltzmann to commit suicide eventually. Yeah, indeed, there's heaps of things going on with all these people. Wolfgang Pauli, interesting. People do confuse him with Linus Pauli, whatever it is. But he had the Pauli exclusion principle, which said that essentially allowed the Bohr theory of the atom, Bohr model of the atom, to limp forward, but not in a very useful way to describe multiple atoms. This is the occupancy of shells, you know, 2, 8, 18, 36, not the 2, 8, 8, 18 model. Bizarre people saying that. Sorry for just chatting like that. Wolfgang Pauli, his mum committed suicide at certain areas. His wives were horrible to him. Maybe, we don't know. Really interesting. Here you got treatment. This is all from ancient New Scientist articles. He was treated by either Freud or Jung for psychology things. It's very interesting to to go through that. So that's the Pauli exclusion principle. Now, practically, for school physics, it says, well, he's the person that allowed that Bohr's model of a single electron to go forward. But for quantum physics, it basically says the basic physics of fermions, which leads to solid-state silicon stuff, and explaining why the matter has bulk form. Okay, now we have to go on to the standard model. Do we have a model which explains? The standard model is the basic thing that is the most successful. After quantum mechanics, it's the most successful model, and it describes three classes of molecule of particle, which have spin and spin orientation. They are the vector boson, scalar boson, the Higgs boson, which is there's only one of, and that's spin zero. Spin and a half are the spin and a half things, which are quarks and leptons. That's right, quarks and leptons. They've all got spin and a half, and spin one are the gauge bosons. Spin one, yeah, that's photons, gluons, W and Z bosons. They're all, well, they're bosons. So, but yeah, if you've got spin of zero or one, it's a boson, and if it's halfway through, it's if it's a half, it's got an S2 symmetry, and it's got a spin. It's a fermion. And so Pauli's exclusion principle applied for fermions. So you've got, in the standard model, you've got four force carriers, which are particles which can have mass, but if they've got mass, the force doesn't go so far. I sort of understand the vector bosons, gauge bosons. I suppose they are vector bosons. Yeah, they are vector gauge. Yeah, they have to be a vector boson because they operate on other vector particles. Okay, so understand it in terms of the Feynman diagrams, but I don't have a visual picture as actually what's inside one. Look, the important thing is that they have spin one, and they have angular momentum So, like a photon carries with it an angular momentum of h. Pretty amazing stuff. You know, and this is photons are quantized. They have spin plus or minus one, or carry plus a angular momentum change in angular momentum associated with having spin plus or minus one. Bosons are scalar stuff. And so a scalar field is like a pressure field. So we've got a pressure field of Higgs bosons around us, and there's all these things to do with symmetry breaking. Let's get into the actual the fermions. This spin a half quarks. You've got up and down, and leptons. You've got electrons and neutrinos. Neutrinos carry no charge and have a mass. And so the theory predicts the mass of all these subparticles. And of course, a proton has a much greater mass than the actual quarks together. So protons and neutrons are made up of the up and down quarks, and this has generations. So Strange and Top and Charm, there's another two generations, and then you've got a muon and a Tor electron. So a muon is that electron which is generated. It's that next generation electron. So That's one of the amazing things in particle physics. That, you know, we are showered with a next generation electron, a heavy electron. You know, a lot of the radiation we feel on Earth are from muons, these heavy electrons coming down. So that's pretty amazing stuff, that all of the radiation that we're bathed with on Earth are from the generation of these second generation electrons coming down. So if you can imagine, the Standard Model has a single vector boson, Higgs. I prefer the drawing of it, the Higgs. It's left to right increasing spin, Higgs. And then a 8x3 array. That's two quarks and two leptons, the electron and the neutrino. That reminds me of something about else that Paulie did, but that's just in my deep, darkest memory. I can't remember it. Please remember, I'm in cardiac rehab and I'm rebooting up. And you can imagine it's a very difficult teaching when you've got to double think about what the actual answer is and what answer you can actually give people. So that's four down, and that's spin half, that's middle group, and then you've got three generations across, and the generation across are these short-lived, unstable versions of it. Now there's quantum string theory. Now the actual quarks are determined by an S3 symmetry rather than an S2 symmetry, and therefore you've got the quarks have different color quantum chromodynamics. And so quarks, a combination of quantum chromodynamics and quarks give you the different things of the mesons. So mesons have spin zero because you've got... So a neutron, for instance, is made out of three quarks. Each quark has a spin a half, so that's got half. But a meson has spin half up, spin... I suppose you could have... Yeah, your spin half, you could have the two spins aligned with two spins unaligned. Now there is one meson which is symmetry breaking. I can't remember, it's just in the back of my head, I cannot remember what's the important of it. There is one, one meson which is symmetry breaking. I don't know what the importance of that is. So you cross, and then you move across to the vector bosons, which are force carriers in the field. And I suppose the interesting for me is how the field moves across in Einstein's general relativity space. Be interested to read articles on it. So that's the general model, and the way we did it is that as you these heavier particles further up require you to pay energy, and the way that we paid energy is by equals mc squared accelerating it up, getting, if you like, the relativistic mass hub, and that's converted to energy and produced is converted into massive other particles, and then we observe the particles by accelerating it. You can only accelerate charged particles, so we get charged particles. We get a charged proton and antiproton together in the CERN, so it's matter and antimatter annihilation to go across. An antiproton has an infinite lifetime, except it annihilates and goes across, and then we can actually track the particles by cloud chambers. This is condensation of super condensed gases, and also a range of detectors, and of course they're the massive detectors. I've got various friends who've worked on the CERN detectors. I really haven't paid too much attention, but they look very good. I think it's the Atlas detector and various things like that, and that has to be underneath the ground, because if it's above ground, you get showered with these muons, which I discussed earlier. So that's the general lecture talk. It's supposed to lecture talk, and you may understand it, or you may have studied it before. You may go off and look at it. Look, it's well worth looking at the Higgs boson, because it's actually quite tractable with hypercharge and symmetry breaking and the Mexican hat potential. It's just very interesting. One of the things I find difficult to understand, I think the hypercharge goes differently on spin-up, spin-down electrons. There's actually one electron which is massless, if you read through it. Again, that's just off the top of my head. I've read it and been under several anesthetics since, so it's all a bit scrambled. So let's get back to had that general talk to the actual... can hear the rain happening here, and it's absolutely freezing out here in Sydney at the moment. I don't know how I'm doing it. It says, describe how the contributions to atomic theory made by Pauli and Heisenberg changed Bohr's model of the atom. Okay, my problem is that Bohr's model of the atom's there, but we have added changes to it. So the advanced changes, and these are... reading backwards, Bohr's model of the atom has a nucleus and rings around it. He's got a flat... That's his model, the atom. So Sommerfeld brought them into elliptical orbits and things like that. But he's got a very flat... Pauli developed the idea of spin, proposed the idea of spin up and spin down, and he also proposed an exclusion principle that allowed quantum mechanics to be fused, reverse engineered into Bohr's theory of the atom. I think this is enough 2 marks to get you there, Pauli, and then 2 marks for Heisenberg. I would expect that's probably how it works. And so Pauli then said there's the various quantum states, so 2s and then 2s and 6p electrons, spin up, spin down, explains the actual occupancy, the 8 occupancy, and his exclusion principle meant that you can't put more than one electron in there to explain what's going on. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle has absolutely been abused by people over in the last century. I don't know whether it's still been abused by people. I must admit, that's a side story. I had a dear friend who was more interested in being a friend, and he eventually died. There were all the top chemists in the wake, and I had a chat to one, and I said, well, now it's time to actually put this classical stuff behind us, and let's go quantum. Let's really go quantum. And didn't quite say it like that. There were other things to discuss at the funeral, obviously. And he said, wait on a minute. The Copenhagen School is really good. I've been calculating individual electron orbits. And he was sort of a senior person in Sydney University, sort of enough to rip your teeth out. Okay, so Heisenberg said the uncertainty principle. And so this meant that we could hand wave and actually say that electrons, the classical, it has been hand waved to modify it to say that there are classical electrons. These are small electrons, and they're orbiting somehow within this range. So the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is saying that we can't actually draw the position of the electron and the momentum of the electron, which is, of course, we do know the momentum of the electron very well, because that relates to its energy. It's in an energy level that's known to infinite precision, and therefore it's... Let's read the answer to this. This is 34C. Coming across here. 34C. Okay, we've done it here. Here's a sample answer. I said, so for 4 marks, describes both Pauli and Heisenberg's ideas and how they changed the Bohr model. Pauli introduced the last quantum number associated with spin. Okay. His exclusion principle states that no 2 electrons can have the same quantum number. This changed Bohr's model by limiting the number of electrons that can exist in each shell. Okay, I think I've said that. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle states that if you know the actual position of a particle, you cannot know the momentum accurately. If you determine its momentum, you cannot specify its position. This changed Bohr's shell into an orbital probability cloud, since precise measurements cannot be made. Well, okay, let's make too much comment about it. I like how it's changed. Well, I suppose it's okay. Let's go on to the next one. Explain how the evidence from experiments involving particle accelerators and detectors has provided support for the standard model of matter. So the standard model of matter consists of 3 groups of particles, spin 0, half and 1. 0 is the Higgs bosons, are the group of fermions, which includes quarks and leptons, and spin 1 transfer are the gauge bosons. With the leptons having 3 generations of particles, and leptons and quarks having 3 generations each. It further, in its model, has quantum chromodynamics, which says how you can actually structure protons and neutrons together. Now, the accelerators get a charged particle and accelerate them to relativistic speeds, which increase the energy and mass, and therefore create a zoo of particles. These particles can be accounted by a combination of applying the laws of physics and the laws, the standard model can predict the actual composition of particles and the mass and various properties of the particles, which are measured and confirmed. The standard model, I've forgotten how many free parameters there are still in the standard model to get. Detectors, by seeing the lifetime charge and mass through... That's have provided evidence. So the accelerators produce the particles, the detectors detect what's produced. So the accelerators produce the stuff going in, the detectors produce the stuff going out. So in versus out matches the standard model. That's the evidence from the process of detectors interacting, measuring the particle accelerators, provide evidence which supports it, like the measurement. I think it's the kaon. There's a neutral kaon which violates symmetry. I don't know where I've read that. I have to look that up. And that's how it supports it. I don't know whether they want. That's how it does. They don't want to know what the actual evidence is. Now let's go forward and read the answer to this one. That's D, and here's the answer. Relates to evidence from accelerators and detectors to development of the standard model. No, I would say the opposite. It says support the standard model. So the standard model, High energy collisions in a particle accelerator produce different types of subatomic particles which have not previously been observed. Properties of these particles, such as momentum and charge, or mass and charge, could be deduced from the measurements using a range of detectors. Okay. The standard model was developed to provide a framework for understanding these new particles. It also predicted the existence of particles which were subsequently produced and detected, providing further evidence to support the standard model. Okay, well, obviously Higgs boson, that's a bit of a circular answer. But it's going across, and I do think this is a successful model where I give the lecture first. So I read the question, give the lecture, or not, it's not a lecture, just more a brain dump. Dump of it, read the question, and then answer the question, and then read the official answer. I think this gives you a general insight. It certainly is good rehab for me, because the information is in there, and it is actually a struggle. So when I say a sentence, I've got two or three thoughts going in at the same time, which I think previously, when I was a bit further under the weather, it meant that I wasn't speaking as well. Thanks for listening. Keep on thinking, doing, and researching. I think you have to research once you do, and then teach science. The actual life of these famous people are pretty amazing. They're pretty far out there. They're people. This is Pauli and Heisenberg. Quite interesting people. They lived in interesting times. Thanks for listening.